I want to set a new standard of care in healthcare. I want to create something that literally elevates the bar for how we deliver healthcare services, and not just in America, in the world. I think that I have an incredibly unique vision, and I'm in an incredibly unique position to do that, being both a physician and a serial entrepreneur and somebody who cares deeply about the health and wellness of others, because as I've seen in medicine, just because you're in medicine doesn't mean that you care about health. We generate a lot of drugs and a lot of medicine. We don't just tend to generate a lot of health.
Welcome to the Role Models Podcast. My name is David, and my guest in this episode today is Robin Burson. Robin is a doctor and entrepreneur and the founder and CEO of Parsley Health, which is a service that is redefining how to deliver medical care in a digital era. In other words, Parsley Health is Robin's answer about how she would redesign healthcare from scratch. We talk about how it is to leave a job you don't like and to go and explore your own ideas, how and why she started her own company, Parsley Health, and how it works, how she found mentors and how to design a relationship with mentors that works for both sides and adds value to both sides. We talk about wellness, about making healthy lifestyle choices, about how to cut through the noise in the health and wellness advice space. We talk about her role as a CEO and how she spends her time in the role, her favorite tips for fundraising and how to work with investors, and she also shares the lessons learned and tips for hiring great people into your company. I feel like we get into a really good flow towards the middle and the end of the conversation when Robin shares a breadth of advice and recommendations, so I encourage you to stick around until the end of this episode. Shout out to the patrons of this episode. We have Megan Quinn, Anna Carolina, and Tim Herbig. All three are $10 per episode patrons, and you can find the causes and the links that they support in the show notes. If you want to become a supporter and make a contribution yourself, perhaps $1 per episode or maybe $3 per episode, whatever works for you, you can find us on patreon.com/role models. By becoming a patron, you directly contribute to making this possible for us to create this podcast, and you also help keep this podcast advertising free. This is the Role Models Podcast. My name is still David. This is episode 19, and have fun with Robin Burson. Robin, welcome to the Role Models Podcast.
So great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time. You are visiting Berlin, and walking into the studio, you shared that you were here 2.5 years ago for 6 weeks. This was the first time you were in Berlin, to basically push the button on the launch of your service. Help us understand, like, what was that? What happened to you 2.5 years ago?
Well, it was very serendipitous that I came here, because I had the idea for my company that summer, and I was working in a medical practice for another doctor in New York City, and I observed everything that was kind of wrong with what was happening. And I had built a model, a P&L, for what I thought was a $1 billion idea for a better way of delivering healthcare. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, my husband, for his work, got this opportunity for us to come live in Europe, in London and Berlin. And it was like the universe had opened the door, and I had to walk through it. And I had the choice of saying, I'm going to stay in my current job where I wasn't especially happy, or I was going to go with him and maybe put this idea into action. So fast forward 2 months later, we're in our Airbnb in Berlin, and we launched the website, and I was taking phone calls, interviewing the people who had become my staff. I was talking to potential customers, and I landed from being here that Christmas time, and then launched the company as soon as I got back.
What's the company?
It's called Parsley Health.
What does
Parsley Health do? Well, we are a new alternative to medical care, where you, through an annual membership, you get access to a team, top doctors, behavioral health coaches, you get nutrition and lifestyle advice, you get detailed testing that looks at things like your microbiome and toxins and hormones. And you not only get a medical team who will handle the pitfalls of the basic things that happen along the way, like infections, but you get a team that's there to help you resolve chronic issues and improve your health for your whole life.
One of my questions that I prepared was, if you could start over with healthcare, mm-hmm. right, from scratch, and redesign it from the ground up. Is this your attempt at? Is this the way you would do it?
Is
the
way exactly you, how I would yeah. do it? So healthcare, and you know, I speak from a knowledge base that's mainly U.S., but I know it. There's varying flavors of problems all around the world, but in the United States, innovation in healthcare has really been stymied in the past by really the payment system, how we pay for our healthcare services. Healthcare services kind of look bad, smell bad, they're dated. They don't work very well. They're not very person-friendly, human-friendly, because you are not paying for your healthcare services directly. There's that insurance layer that's the intermediary. And as a result of that, healthcare is designed for insurance companies. It's not designed for you. And so by taking it out of that and really starting completely outside of the system, we're really revolutionary in that Parsley Health is a direct-to-consumer healthcare service, meaning you pay for it, you pay for what you get. And it's $150 a month. And for that fee, you get access to everything I described before. And because we are direct to consumer, we can deploy UX principles, we can implement data science, we can use predictive analytics, we can actually create something that is healthcare, but it's designed around you. And we face all of the pressures, right, of a consumer business, because our consumers, our patients are paying us for our services. And so we have to constantly iterate and evolve and develop what we're doing to meet them and their requests and their needs. We have to listen to them. All of these things don't happen in the conventional healthcare setting. So I have this amazing and unique opportunity outside of the current system, such as it is, to truly innovate. And so when we are venture-backed, and when I talk to our investors or to people in the space, they all say, well, how are you going to then work with insurance? How are you going to then work with the system? That's the easy part. That part can all come. What the hard part is developing something that's really designed around the user in healthcare, and we have that very special and perfect opportunity to do that right now, but that means we have to stick to our guns and keep doing that.
I want to go back to the service and the product and mm-hmm. and what you do, but you said something at the beginning of the conversation when you said you were in a job and you were not happy. Place us back in that time.
I was in a job at that particular time where the culture just wasn't a great fit for me. I'm someone who's, I think I've always been a bit innovative. I've always been entrepreneurial. Parsley Health is my second company. I co-founded a tech company called Curator when I was still in med school. That's a HIPAA compliant or secure messaging platform for healthcare providers. And I was just in a sort of, medicine tends to have a pretty old school culture, especially more than maybe any other industry. Certainly it's up there. And I was in a culture where I just wasn't a fit. And I was really grateful to be there because it was a clinical knowledge base. I was learning something that I really needed to learn to take the next step. And so I was appreciative of that. But as I crested the top of that learning curve, I eventually saw that when it's kind of like a relationship. Once you see the end, it's over. It's hard to stay. And so I saw the end. And so then the question was, well, do I want to, you know, just launch a medical practice? Do I want to go work somewhere else? Because I had already had an experience helping to start a company, I think I was prepared to then go off on my own and start this one. And so to people who are sort of stuck somewhere and are thinking, how do I get out? No experience is wasted. You know, my first job out of college, I was a paralegal at the U.S. Attorney's Office prosecuting Martha Stewart and securities fraud. And I remember thinking, I'm glad somebody does this. It definitely needs to happen, but it should not be me. And I cataloged everything I hated about that job. Things like sitting all the time and looking at a computer all the time and something that was punitive as opposed to helpful. And then hating all those specific and granular things about that particular job helped me then switch gears and go into healthcare. At the time, I switched to psychiatry research because I could use what I didn't like to help me discover what I did like. And so then fast forward to the medical job before I started Parsley, everything that I saw that I didn't like in that scenario gave me fodder, gave me ideas, gave me inspiration for the things that I would want to change and create once I started my own thing. And so I always encourage people not to feel frustrated where they are, rather take a step back and say, does this give me inspiration for what I want to change? Or if I'm just not in the field I want to be at all, what do I not like about this field? And what's the equal and opposite that I can then go pursue in the world? Because everything's out there.
Have you found a practice to figure that out that works for you?
The practice in terms of what I'm doing now? Or?
To zoom out and to step back. And what do you do then? Like, what do you practically do then?
Well, I think you practically have to find something that you're enthusiastic for. The ways that I've sort of found my way through the world, it's definitely been through mentorship. And people always say, well, how do I find a mentor? And it's like, well, you find a mentor by finding the people and who do the things that you love to do, that you're enthusiastic about, that you're excited about, and reaching out to them with that enthusiasm. All the mentors that I've gotten along the way who have helped guide me forward are people who I just genuinely connected with, even though I had not necessarily experience in their field. I connected with them because I loved what they were doing. I shared that love with them. And when they saw how enthusiastic I was about what they were interested in, they just naturally wanted to help me. So I think rather than starting with this amorphous idea of like, I need a mentor, how do I go find them? Start with the thing that you're really excited about. So when I was working in the U.S. Attorney's Office, I was sort of escaping my job every day because I really didn't like it. And I was going to yoga class. And I had this epiphany that yoga was helping me reconnect my mind and my body. And that was a really new idea for me at age 22. And so I suddenly got really interested in the connection between the mind and the body and mind-body medicine. And just through a Google search, I found this professor at NYU was teaching a course on mind-body medicine. And he let me come attend a lecture of the course for free. And then he connected me with the group at NYU who's doing mental health and addiction disorders research that then hired me as a research coordinator. And then the head of that program, who was my mentor there, ended up writing my recommendation letters for medical school. So it was because I found somebody and shared this common interest that they just opened those doors.
Have you found the way you describe it sounds simple? Right. So, and I'm sure it wasn't maybe that simple. So do you have some advice on the different steps to that process? Like to reach out to a person, what is it? What is an effective way of doing that? How do you establish a connection with someone who you then can later maybe call a mentor? And how do you nurture that relationship?
I think certainly reaching out to someone and expressing specifically how you love their work, why you love their work, why you're interested in what they're doing, and simply saying, I want to learn more is a great way. And to make yourself really accessible and available, a lot of people, I'm honored and flattered, but a lot of people will reach out to me. And the ones who just want to get my advice on their career, that's something that as a busy person, I just don't have time for. I'm not even sure how I could possibly advise them. But for people who reach out and say, I love your work for reasons A, B, and C. I've read X, Y, and Z. They really bring specifics. They really bring research and say, could I come shadow your team for 2 hours on a Monday morning? That's a really simple ask. And if they share maybe their CV and their background and why they're interested, we're really open to making space for them to come shadow. And then that can germinate the beginning of a relationship. And, you know, it's certainly picking your spots and not, you know, doing that for 100 people, but picking a couple people who you really admire and have a specific goal in learning more about their work. They could end up helping you and opening doors for you. Or at minimum, you may go shadow them or go to their lecture or their office or whatever it is. And you might learn, hey, I thought I was really into that, but I'm not. And that's valuable too, like cutting out the things that are not interesting. I definitely, at that phase when I was sort of searching, went out and met with different people who I didn't end up working for, who didn't become mentors. But I learned a bit about who they were and what they did, and that helped me cross things off the list, which is valuable too.
Yeah, I think it's two great pieces there. Is that one is the transactional advice, right? Like a person reaches out and says, like, I have this following question. Can you give me an hour of your time to answer that question for me, right? I think that's a very transactional way, which is hard to say yes to to make time and space throughout a busy day. And then the other piece is around, sometimes it's not about the having an actual personal relationship. It's like you can observe and you can look what people do and then and then find a mentorship, extract advice from that without even, before even establishing a personal relationship with that person.
Yeah.
You went to medical school, so you became a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Well, back to when I was 22 and had this epiphany that we're all walking around with this concrete wall between our heads and our bodies, and that if you break through the wall and suddenly start paying attention to this physical vehicle which carries us through the world, you take care of it a little bit better, and that perhaps that taking care of one's physical vehicle a bit better could answer a lot of our major health costs and chronic disease burden. 86% of our diseases today are lifestyle driven or modifiable. There are things like mental health imbalances and depression and diabetes and heart disease and weight gain and autoimmune diseases and hormone imbalances. We are living ourselves sick as a society. And I had that realization, and I looked at the space, and I was becoming really passionate about things like yoga and meditation and nutrition. But deep down somewhere, I knew that I needed the MD, I needed the medical credential to really have an impact. And I don't think that's the right answer for everyone. But for me, it was clear that I needed to know the science of what I was talking about. And I needed, if I were going to lead in this field, I needed everyone else to know that I knew the science of what I was talking about, that I had gone to one of the top medical schools in the United States. I went to Columbia, which was an amazing education that I loved, and that I could take all of that and expand upon it, that I wasn't out of turn rejecting it. And again, that was my path forward, but I trained at Columbia and then at Mount Sinai. I still practice medicine today, so I'm one of the doctors at Parsley Health. That's critical. I see patients one day a week, and that means that our clinical teams, our doctors and health coaches, see me as one of them, and I can relate to them. It means that I'm using the technology that we're building every day as a user myself, so it helps me really understand what we're doing and develop the tech side of our product in a much more hands-on way than if I were just not actually doing the work of seeing patients. It helps me stay on top of the research and the science that I need to communicate to the world. And so it's a really long road, but it was clear to me that I wanted that foundation of education to be able to use it later. So you were saying, I think earlier, that some of the folks that you've talked to are very early in their careers, and I'm certainly early in Parsley Health. This is only into the third year that Parsley Health has existed in the world. And we've made incredible progress. We've launched two new cities and raised two rounds of venture capital, and we're doing incredible work. But I'm not 2 or 3 years into my career. I went to medical school. I founded another company along the way. And all that said, I still feel like I'm just getting started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the people are early in their careers. The guests on our event, guests on the podcast. Sorry, I didn't tell this. Explain this correctly. Yeah. I think there's two interesting paths that converge into that moment. Is this one you mentioned earlier, that you've always been entrepreneurial, and that you wanted to have this, you know, gain this credibility and authority in the space, in the medical space, by studying it, right? Mm-hmm. And by getting the MD. How do you put those two worlds together, medical science on the one end, and then the entrepreneurial spirit? Where is that rooted?
They're two interesting worlds, because as I've discussed with some awesome top doctors and medical doctors who are also founders in the health tech space, medicine is a very hierarchical and tracked kind of world. So there's not as much room for entrepreneurship inside of it. And we often find that people who are in medicine who feel entrepreneurial or want to create new things often leave. They go to biotech or they go to the digital space, and they don't feel like the two worlds can meet, which is unfortunate. But on the other hand, studying medicine is an all-consuming thing. And so for me, along the way, I stayed really focused on my medical studies, because I knew that this was the foundation, that without this, I couldn't do the rest. Now, that said, I co-founded a startup in my fourth year of medical school and into my first year of residency training in a hospital, and found time along the way to eke out these other experiences that then prepared me for the company I'm working on today. I stayed teaching yoga, which I was also passionate about, all the way through medical school, and only stopped really when I started residency training in the hospital and then had literally no time. I kept these little parts of myself alive in the times that I had so that I could stay being that whole person, being that super connected person. You know, yoga and this idea of health and wellness were why I went to medical school in the first place. So I just set a rule for myself. I'm going to maintain these other aspects of myself while I go through this long period of training. And I went in with that intention and I was successful at that. I think if I just shown up at med school with no direction around that, it would have been really hard and I would have allowed medical school to become completely consuming. But because I had this other mission in mind, I was able to carve out these extra times.
I'm a little bit overwhelmed by the amount of noise that's out there around making healthy lifestyle choices, right? So you mentioned that 86% or 68%?
86%.
86% of diseases or medical conditions emerge from lifestyle choices. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pseudoscience out there, and there's a lot of products that promise some sort of healthy effect, mm-hmm. or health effect. But become an industry. And when there's an industry in play, it's all about selling that product. What advice do you have for me, overwhelmed in this landscape? What advice can you share with people to cut through that noise?
There is a ton of noise. I was just interviewed for an article at a magazine at home that is calling it the wellness epidemic. And I laughed at that because if we really have an epidemic of wellness, then that's not the biggest problem in the world. I hope that that's our biggest problem,
that we truly have
an epidemic of wellness. I don't think we do. I think most people, as I mentioned before, could use more wellness in their lives. And so as industries go, it's not the worst one. But that said, there is a lot of noise. And I think that people have to remember one thing, that all of this information that's out there is general information. It's not specific to you. And so one of the reasons I created Parsley Health is that, you know, I'm a doctor. I spend all day and night thinking about these things. You don't work in medicine. You don't spend all day and night thinking about these things. I'm going to ask you about podcasts and tech, and you're going to ask me about medicine, right? But we all need a guide. And so work with an educated practitioner who gets to know you, because the nuances of what's good for you are not going to be shared, you know, in a blog post or on the back label of a package or by a juice company. You know, what works for somebody else might not work for you. And so the body is nuanced and the body is complicated, and get some advice and guidance from an expert before you spend all your money on the latest fad.
And that's where Parsley comes into play. So let's say I sign up for Parsley. What's my journey like? What's my experience like?
You register online and become a member, and then you schedule online your first doctor's visit. Your first doctor's visit is 75 minutes. That's five times what the average person spends with their doctor in a year in the United States. That 75-minute intake is a deep dive through your entire health story. We create a map of your health story from before you were born and your family history to how you were born, whether it was C-section or not, the medications you've had over your life, the major traumas and incidents, any diagnoses that you've had. And we create this monster map of your health history, all leading up to how you're feeling today. And we go through that. We do a physical exam. And then your doctor gives you a plan, a blueprint, a starting place that will be iterated on throughout your journey with Parsley. You also meet your health coach, who's somebody who's educated in nutrition and also educated in how to hold someone accountable and motivate someone to continue making changes. So your doctor will recommend a plan that will include things like potentially medications, supplements, specific nutrition guidelines, testing, and your health coach will help make sure that you actually do those things. And then every quarter, if not more frequently, throughout your membership in the year. You'll continue to meet with your doctor. You'll go over test results. Your plan will be iterated upon. We'll see how you're doing. If in between something happens, you have a sinus infection or something minor comes up or you need some guidance, we're there for you. We have unlimited messaging, so you can write to us all the time. And so our members interact with their doctor for over 200 minutes a year. Again, the average person is 15 minutes in the U.S. per year. So that's
15 minutes versus 200 minutes.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
So the average person spends 15 minutes a year with their primary care doctor, and our patients spend over 200 minutes with our doctors at Parsley. That's not including the many sessions they might spend with their health coach. And they get 24 sessions with their health coach per year that they can use, as well as unlimited messaging back and forth with their doctor. Usually you have to go through a secretary or an admin person to write to your doctor. We've stripped all that away, and online you can just message with your doctor at any time, and they'll write you back. So we've really taken away a lot of the barriers to relationships in medicine and use technology to actually break down those barriers and make it easier to have a team that who actually knows you over time.
Why is healthcare and healthcare system not like that?
Because we are incentivized in healthcare today by volume. So doctors today, to survive, primary care doctors are paid very little. They have to see many patients, 25 patients in a day, 30 patients in a day, and have thousands of patients on their list per year in order to survive. They need to get you in and out that door as fast as possible. They're incentivized to write a prescription most of the time just to get you to kind of go away and finish the visit. 70 to 80% of primary care visits in the U.S. result in a prescription drug. At Parsley Health, it's 10%. So we've reduced prescription drugs by 60% at Parsley, which could mean saving the healthcare system billions of dollars.
What is the vision of that? Like, where are you taking this?
We've started out with this incredible nucleus in three cities of three practices, doctors all practicing in the same way as teams with health coaches. And we are building out the tech platform that will allow us to make it easier and easier to deliver great care reliably. We're building predictive analytics that show us how well a person is doing or is going to do. We can flag whether or not one provider is doing as well as another, whether one center is doing as well as another. And we'll continue to grow this medical service and make it more and more efficient, more and more tech-driven as we grow it. And then ultimately, we will eventually take insurance. So instead of being 100% direct-to-consumer the way that we are now, bring in the insurance market so that we're able to lower the prices even further without sacrificing quality of care, and grow this to be a huge healthcare company that offers this service to many, many people who, you know, today couldn't have access to it.
Talk a little bit about your day-to-day role. Like, you're the founder and the CEO of the company. How do you define the role of a CEO for you right now?
It's definitely been changing as we've grown. And that's one thing that I think that when people start their own company, everyone says, well, think about what you're good at and, you know, spend most of your time doing that. And that's completely unrealistic. When you start a company, I started Parsley completely bootstrapped, no outside funding, with a team of three other than myself, two of whom are part-time. So I did everything. I was doing the things I was good at, the things I was not good at, you know, 7 days a week. And as we've grown, I think one of the biggest challenges for me has been to recognize what I'm not as good at and to hire really top-tier talent to be that person for me. And then the even more challenging thing than hiring them has been to trust them to actually do it and not need to own everything myself. Because when you go from doing everything yourself to handing those reins over, that can feel sticky, right? However, if I can't do that, we can't grow. And I can't achieve my vision without other amazing people. And so I've been really happy to hire incredible engineers and designers and operators to begin taking over people who are better at the things that I'm not good at, such as some of the day-to-day ops who have done it before and can come teach me something. That's been really gratifying and exciting. And so now my role as CEO, I've learned, is always changing. I see patients one day a week. So part of my time is still being in the product, being one of our clinicians, relating and managing our doctors and health coaches as one of them. That's a big part of my role, and that's very specific to the kind of company that I have. Investor relations and raising money, that's also my job. So I've been in charge of that. Doing sort of the outward world facing kind of thing. So being on this podcast and speaking at TOA yesterday and sharing my vision with the world is part of it. Recruiting is a huge part of it. So while a year ago, that wasn't as much what I was focused on, right now, that's probably 50-60% of what I'm focused on because we closed around the spring. And so now I'm continuing to develop our talent across all areas. And then the last part is product. So still today, I'm a big driver of what is Parsley Health. We started off with this awesome service. It's been really revolutionary, but now we need to A/B test it and iterate on it and develop it and change it. And the membership we started with isn't going to be the membership we end up with. And I'm still very much at the center of that with our engineers and our designers and our other doctors, our data scientists, analyzing what we've got and then creating and iterating on top of that. So
it's a subscription based membership, and but with the difference is that you don't buy a virtual subscription, like for example Spotify or Netflix, right? Mm-hmm. There's a person involved in that, and there's health and there's a body involved in that.
Yeah.
What dynamic does that create of running a subscription-based business when at the center of that is the patient and the doctor and the relationship between them and probably also the data that is amassed between that?
It's really interesting. So yes, humans are not, audiophiles that they can be shot back and forth through the internet, nor are they Subway sandwiches that can be made in an assembly line. And so the dynamics are much deeper and much more nuanced. That said, healthcare, I fundamentally believe, is a human business powered by technology. And I see a lot of people trying to make it a tech business powered by humans. That is not what it is or is going to be and should be for a very long time. And so the architecture of the subscription model is actually designed to create a longitudinal relationship, which is what needs to happen in medicine. So today in medicine, what we have is a system that reinforces episodic care. You pay as you go. You pay for an hour of the doctor's time if you're paying outright, or you're paying, a copay per visit, and the insurance company pays the provider for more stuff, more time, more drugs, more procedures, whatever it might be. We aren't incentivized that way. We have an annual membership. You can pay monthly or upfront. And so that creates a space where we say, we are going to be your doctor for a year. This means that we need to have, and hopefully many years of your life. But at minimum, this isn't going to be done in a day. This isn't a quick fix. It's not a one-time visit. And you're not paying for hours of our time. You're paying for a place where you can access all of your data, a relationship with a set of expert guides who care about you and who are going to help you manage your own data, people who are going to help you investigate what's going on with you. And we're going to learn together over time. And so while humans are definitely, I think, more difficult to manage than sound files, the entire idea of a membership or a subscription basis for medicine, to me, is really fundamental to our philosophy. We will not sell you a visit. There is no price for which we'll offer that.
Talk a bit about fundraising. You are a VC-backed company, and which requires going to an investor and convincing them that you're the team that's going to solve that problem with that solution that you have in place. Take us behind the scenes of fundraising for people in the audience who are considering to start their own company and are considering to take a path of VC or maybe another path of financing. What advice can you share on that, looking back at your time fundraising?
It's definitely been a learning curve. While I had participated in a little bit in fundraising for my last company, nothing like this and never on my own. So Parsley Health has certainly been an education and something that, And, you know, raising venture capital, you do not learn in medical school. I will tell you that. So what advice do I have? Get a lot of advice. Find advisors. My advisors from early on in the company, other founders who have done this multiple times themselves, are investors themselves. Make sure that your advisors, a lot of people give advisors equity, and we have done that at Parsley Health, and we have amazing group of advisors, but they're people I trust, people who have really looked out for me, people who have done this before, who have raised money before or invest themselves, and really get them to be honest with you. What does your pitch deck have to look like? What are the metrics that you are expected to know? Practice your pitch with them and get feedback. Don't feel badly that you don't know how to do this, because you don't know how to do this. And there is a lot of trial and error, I'll say, and you will, no matter what you do, you will not end up with the same pitch your first investor meeting as your 20th investor meeting. It will evolve, and it should evolve. But make sure you're getting that feedback along the way. And when people turn you down, and they will, I don't know what the statistic is, but it's something like, you know, 9 out of 10 say no, or maybe it's a 99 out of 100. I don't know what it is, but people will say no to you. Expect that. Somebody saying no to you is not, your idea is terrible and not worth doing. There's a lot of capital out there, a lot. And so there's a lot of places for it to go. But when they do say no, unless it's something really obvious, like it's just not in the space in which they invest and something they look at, you know, some people just don't invest in healthcare. And so that is what it is. But try to learn from them when they say no. Try to get one piece of meaningful feedback. And then again, bring in those people who you really trust, who are going to be honest with you, who are advisors, who know what they're doing, and incentivize them a little bit to help you, because you can't do it alone.
Having gone through this with trial and error and perfecting the investor pitch, what have you found to be the element of the pitch that has had the most impact on a decision of a VC to say yes?
It really depends on the investor, I'll be honest with that. And so all investors are not the same, and what motivates them or what they care about is not always the same. Certainly have your numbers buttoned up, know your unit metrics, know your margins, know how much capital you need and what you intend to do with it. But in the early days, when you're really early stage, so pre-seed, angel round, and then seed stage, and I think even, you know, we're pre-Series A, but even through Series A, to some degree, although less so, you're still selling a vision, you're selling a dream. And so you have to be able to articulate how your dream is going to change the world, where that product market fit lies, where the thing that you're creating is actually solving a pain point that somebody out there, whether it's an enterprise solution or an individual consumer, that somebody's going to buy, what evidence you think you have to share that, and the real why of what you're doing. Have that really clear, and share a really big vision, and don't be afraid to do that, because investors see a lot of companies, if this is what they do for a living, if they're, you know, a VC and this is all they do is look at companies. You not only have to have your metrics buttoned up, you also have to get them really excited about who you are and what you're going to bring to the world, because by investing in you, they're going to be a part of that. And so from what I've seen, it's this balance, I think, between your metrics and also being able to share a vision and a dream of what you can achieve in the world, because they're going to become your partners in that.
You're really great at telling that story, like from the beginning, like your background, your transition into med school, and then becoming an entrepreneur, two-time entrepreneur. How did you become so good at storytelling?
I don't know that I am good at storytelling, but I've always been a writer. It's always been something that I've liked to do. Certainly, I think I got to see a bit of it. As I mentioned to you when we were walking up briefly, I was the radio show producer for Dr. Mehmet Oz, who now is a television doctor and has a TV show. But at the time, he did not have that. He just had a radio show, and he was a heart surgeon. And I got to hear him tell stories. And as part of that show, I had all the guests on the show had a book, and I had to read all the books in advance and write down questions for him to ask them. So I read a lot of books of a lot of other doctors and health experts and wellness experts telling stories. And then I think also my passion for what I'm doing really is what drives me. And so when I try to talk about this in the abstract, I think it can come across really wonky and really boring really fast. But when I stick to what I know, which is why I'm doing this and why this can really impact people, it becomes very easy to talk about it the same way I would talk to a friend.
What is that drive?
I want to set a new standard of care in healthcare. I want to create something that literally elevates the bar for how we deliver healthcare services, and not just in America, in the world. I think that I have an incredibly unique vision, and I'm in an incredibly unique position to do that, being both a physician and a serial entrepreneur and somebody who cares deeply about the health and wellness of others. Because as I've seen in medicine, just because you're in medicine doesn't mean that you care about health. We generate a lot of drugs and a lot of medicine. We don't just tend to generate a lot of health. And so I think I'm uniquely positioned, and I think the world will be a genuinely better place if we all are healthier and we have the support we need to be there.
I want to go further back and ask you what influenced the path you went on early on in your life. Where is this influence, or where is this passion and this drive rooted?
I think the specific place for me that it started was really immediately after college or university, for me working again at the U.S. Attorney's Office in securities fraud, not understanding why I was there, hating my job and wanting to escape, and discovering for myself through my yoga practice that I was pretty disconnected from myself, that I was living in my head and not in my body. I think at the time I was pretty much living on Diet Coke and like really bad streetcar coffee and going out at night in New York City and partying. And I was anxious and I had bad skin and I wasn't particularly unhealthy. But I definitely defined health with being skinny. I didn't care about how I felt as long as I was skinny, as many American women feel. And I wasn't very happy with all of that. And I didn't recognize that any of that was a problem, because that all seemed to me pretty normal, until I got into my yoga practice and realized that, wow, looking at the world that way and treating my body that way wasn't making me very happy and didn't make me feel very good. And I think there's a great Eve Ensler quote. I'm definitely stealing it from her, the creator of the Vagina Monologues. But she said that happiness is giving the world what you want most yourself. And for me, I think that through my yoga practice and changing how I ate and how I related to myself, I discovered this thing that I thought, wow, I want this for me. And I think I could create this in a huge way for other people somehow. And that was just the beginning of getting from there to medicine, to starting Parsley Health. And why I connected all those dots in that particular way, I have no idea, but that's really how it happened.
If you would have to connect those dots, what would be your attempt?
It's a great question. I can't answer why some doctors love patient care. They love that one-to-one, right? And other doctors, love the science of it, right? The research element of it. And there's a few of us who go into medicine because we care about health and healing, but we also need to get out of the micro, the one-to-one or the cellular structure, and think really big and broad and solve problems at scale. And I cannot answer for you why I happen to be one of those weird birds that needs to take that big step back and say, it's not enough for me to understand the cell or the molecule, and it's not enough for me to see people hour after hour, day after day, one-to-one, and help people one at a time. I need to translate this learning into something that feels broad spectrum. And I don't know if that is where that comes from. I wasn't raised by people who were particularly entrepreneurial. They were much more academic. I grew up in Baltimore. I wasn't raised in a particularly entrepreneurial community. I think it's just something in my nature sees big problems and says, well, I want to do something about that.
How do you assess whether or not the problem is worth solving?
Also a great question. And in health, every problem is worth solving. I mean, when you see somebody suffering from a condition that they don't need to suffer from, when you see and look at the macro trends around how many people are sick and the trillions of dollars that we're spending ineptly in healthcare. When you see something like health that literally affects every single human from before they're born, we now know that the foods a mom eats and how stressed she is, and even the effects of the microbiome, her bacterial population on her infant in utero, impact that baby's health throughout their lifetime. This is every single one of us, and it's very, very human. And so I love the work that I do. I don't think I could be as connected to it if it were something that were entirely in the cloud, where it just lived in the digital space and it weren't very clear to me how we're affecting real humans day to day. For me, that human touch and interaction, that physicality is really powerful and is the space in which I want to be.
So it means that you, with Parsley, there will be, you choose the personal connection between the doctor and the patient, and you're not going to put this as a virtual medical platform where you can dial in and then check in with your doctor who's somewhere around the world?
Well, we already offer that. So I do believe that telemedicine is certainly the way of the future. It's not even the future, it's now. Mm-hmm. I don't think that telemedicine, there are a lot of telemedicine companies, which confuses me. Telemedicine is a feature to me, not a company. It's just part of how we communicate. So after your first doctor's visit, which is in person at Parsley Health, any visit with your coach or your doctor can be virtual over secure video. We already have patients who've flown to see us from around the United States and the world to do their first doctor's visit in person, and after that are continuing with us virtually. And I think ultimately we'll allow for 100% virtual care where we can reach people who couldn't otherwise come in person, because we don't want that to be a barrier. But I don't think that that sacrifices the quality of the relationship. I think ultimately Parsley Health is a health experiences company more than a medical care company, in that we have a particular philosophy of health where we know that your context, your environment, your history, your story, your stress levels, your food, your medications, your genomics, your microbiome, we know that this 360 view of you is how are the factors that need to be accounted for if you're going to be healthy. We're going to account for all of them and help guide you to better health, whether we do that in person as your doctor and we also write you prescriptions for antibiotics when you need them, or we have part of our platform that anyone can plug into and get a very personalized view of their health. But at the core of it, starting with that really prized doctor-patient relationship that is human, for me, is where we had to start, because I see a lot of people in healthcare building these virtual platforms to help people with this and that, and they're totally divorced from any individual's reality. I don't think that they get it. By starting with the medical care itself and making that awesome, it then allows us to generate these other ways for people to plug in even before they necessarily see us as their doctor.
What would you say is your biggest challenge, right, in your current in your role as a CEO in the current time frame?
Again, it changes quarter to quarter. Last Q2 of 2017, it was fundraising. Done with that. So currently, that's not a problem. Right now, I would say it's just recruiting. Recruiting, no matter what people say or how good you are at it or how attractive your company, it just takes time. You have to find the right people. You have to get to know them. You really want to hire slowly and fire quickly. I tend to abide by that adage. You know, you really want to pick great people for your team and get to know them and make sure they know what they're getting themselves into and you know what you're getting yourself into, so that hopefully they'll last with you for a long time and really grow with you. And that is also an art form like fundraising that you get better and better at as you do it. And you probably, unless you've done it a lot before somewhere else, when you first start your own company, you may not be as good at that. You're also not going to know what you need necessarily until you're there. And as you grow with your company, you begin to have a longer and longer horizon, and you're better and better at able to see, I'm going to need this in a year, I'm going to need this in 2 years, and to hire against that. When you're first starting out, don't beat yourself up. You don't know what you need in 2 months. And with the person that you hire, the first nurse that I hire, I was convinced when I started the first clinic that I needed a nurse in a certain role at Parsley Health, because that's what I'd seen other places. And within 30, 60 days max, I clearly saw that somebody with a nursing degree was the wrong person to hire for this particular role. And I unfortunately had to let not unfortunately, I had to let the nurse go because she wasn't the right fit for the role. She wasn't happy. I wasn't happy. It was great for her. And hire somebody with a really different background to do what was ultimately more of an administrative and customer service type of role than something that required a nursing degree. And I just didn't get that until I was in it. And so now I don't have that sort of 60-day horizon on what I need. That said, at Parsley, certainly, and at a lot of companies I see, roles are changing all the time. So we have amazing health coaches at Parsley. The health coaching role has changed quite a bit in the past less than two quarters. And there's friction there. And one of the challenges that we're facing as a company right now is how to take awesome people who you love, who you want to be happy in their roles, explain to them and get buy-in that that role needs to change somewhat, not completely, but somewhat because of business objectives and business imperatives. And then how do you retrain them, equip them with the right tools and technology to let them do this new role and be there and create space and hear them and have them be involved in that decision-making process so that you don't have a situation where you've kind of flipped, it feels to them like you flipped everything up in the air and now they have this new job. And so that's been a huge learning experience for me is that, wow, we have the perfect people in the role, we've hired well, but we now need to do them to do something a little bit differently. How do we go from that realization to having that happen seamlessly? It's not easy, but if you say ahead of that, that it's not going to be easy and you plan for it well, it can go pretty well.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And one follow-up on that, what would you say were your key, what would you say are mistakes to avoid now looking back at the amount of people you've hired is, can you share for people who are, you know, about to make that go in that journey in hiring, what are some mistakes that you've made or that you've experienced others make that you would flag?
Know what success for that person in that role looks like. And I'm sure you hear that a lot, but like literally write it down. What, when in a month from now, how, if they're successful, what has happened in 90 days, in 6 months, in a year? What is going to get them? What are the KPIs, key performance indicators, that you want them to help you achieve? And how are you going to know if they've helped you and if they've helped you in a reasonable amount of time? You may need to talk to advisors and friends or people with other companies who've hired similar roles to even define what those KPIs are and what the expectations should be and what those timelines should be. You may need to get outside advice. So that's really helpful. I'm a doctor. So when I'm hiring somebody who's a digital marketer or a content strategist, I am not a content strategist. I am not a digital marketer. I cannot be the person to solely define the nitty gritty of what that success is going to look like. So I've had to go to advisors, friends in the space, others to help me define that so that it's not nebulous, so that you can't say in 3 months, well, I'm not happy with this person's performance. Well, why? Did I set expectations clearly? That's one. And then the second thing I think is really critical is different people have different ways of approaching a job. And in a startup, you need a seek and solve mentality. You need people who are going to say,
Seek and solve.
So you need people who are not going to just sort of wait for the problems to like fall on their heads and then deal with them. You need the people who are saying, hey, we're doing this way, but I think we could be doing it a little bit better. And here's what I want to test. Because as you grow your organization, you can't be the person seeing all of those things and asking people to change them. You need your team to be empowered and engaged enough to look for those kinds of little problems because they're going to be there no matter what you do. As you grow, the problems and the targets are going to constantly be changing. You need your team to be able to look for them and be proactive and suggest solutions. So looking for people who have either been at other startups and have demonstrated this in the past or in some way in their past lives, whatever they've done before, have demonstrated the ability to find problems and solve them without needing to be handheld. That's a huge quality in, I think, hiring someone in a startup atmosphere that you need to look for.
How would your team describe you as a leader?
I think they would describe me as quite visionary because I'm always sharing with them why we're doing what we're doing and have very big ideas for what the future of the company looks like. And so I think that's helpful because somebody has to do that. And that's definitely the role of the CEO. I think they would also describe me as detail oriented. You know, no dream is too big, but no detail is too small, especially when it comes to customer service. So you'll literally see me sitting on the floor of our office cutting off like a dead frond of a fern on a plant because I like see it and need to fix that immediately because I don't want any patient to walk in and see if we can't keep the plants alive, then I mean, come on. It's not so great for a healthcare company. And I think they would describe me as hopefully anyway, compassionate. I mean, one thing that we've really tried to do at Parsley is to really hear everyone. So I want to hear how it's going for everyone. I don't want them to bullshit me. I want them to tell me the real story. What's going well, what's not going well, how can they be more supported. And at the same time, I always ask them, okay, come to me with problems, but also come with solutions. You can come to me with as many problems as you want, but don't come to me to complain because I've got a longer list of problems than you do. Every day your job as a CEO is to like put out 100 fires and see the next 100 coming down the line. But, you know, don't come just with problems. Come with what are your top two ways you think we could solve that? And then I'll hear you. And if I think it's an awesome idea, I'll green light it and then you can go solve it.
Where do you find the strength to walk through the fire?
I find it personally through my meditation practice, through yoga, and through reconnecting why the hell I did this in the first place. So I think it's really important to stop and take stock on a regular basis. I think it's important as a founder to build in moments at least quarterly, if not more frequently, in your schedule, a weekend, a couple days, a vacation, a retreat, just a pause to reinvest in yourself, in your energy, and that connection with why you're doing this, because that is going to give you the momentum and the resilience to see beyond, you know, most of the fires are little things. They're just little problems. They just need to be solved. They will be solved. Other people have solved them. You're not the first person to have done this. It's okay. But you have to have that reason to keep going and not to get bogged down. And I think just building in time for yourself to do that as one of the key important things that you do is really critical. And I know that whenever I like drop that and forget to build in that time to take a step back, when I'm getting frayed, if I'm frayed, the team is frayed. So I have to make sure that I am able to rise above that first and foremost.
Talk a little bit about meditation, because we haven't talked much about this today. And I struggle with meditation on and off. And I'm curious to better understand what is working for you. What type of meditation? How do you stay disciplined in your practice of meditation? What is some advice you can share there? It seems to be this recurring theme that seems to be the thing. Meditation seems to be a thing that helps people over the long term. And what's the mystery?
I would say meditation is the most powerful tool I have, literally, full stop. And it's a practice that has enabled me to do what I do. It's enabled me to be creative. It's enabled me to be calm, to be healthy, and to set the vision for my company. Meditation has been shown to decrease inflammation in the body, to activate the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the rest, digest, relax, and heal side of our nervous system. It's, you know, the research on it is astounding. I think that we have to remember that in the past 10 years, the iPhone came out in 2007, and in 10 years, the way that we spend our time, the way that we work, and the way that our attention is manipulated has radically changed. 10 years. This is a very short period of time. When I was born in the early 1980s, not the case. And so we can't just sort of allow that radical change to happen and then not see that it's going to have profound effects on our well-being or how we feel in the world. And so meditation, I believe, is the antidote. Mobile device addiction is real. Great neuroscientists, some of the top ones in the world, one here in Germany, has codified that and shown that mobile devices and electronic devices can actually over time induce a form of dementia. Our attention is constantly split between a million different things and a million different moments. And if you're constantly in that mode from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, you're living in emergency. Your brain is then telling your physical body, I'm in emergency. It's as if you're running from a lion all day long, every single day, because there's so much going on and you have to run, and you never stop. And that is an unsustainable, dysfunctional way for your body to live. So if your body is always in that state, your immune system breaks down and can't fight off cancer as well. It can't fight off infections as well. Your metabolics are affected. And so that's part of why people are gaining weight. Cortisol's high, which spikes blood sugar, which spikes insulin, and we're gaining weight and we have diabetes. All of these things come from the state in which we're living our lives. And so it's not that we're going to go live in a cave, but we need those antidotes. And so meditation is a really powerful antidote. I've given up on the idea of discipline around it. I think that's like a hopeless battle, at least for me. I know
that's nice to hear.
For me, it's not about doing it at the same time every day, although I know that people swear by that. It's fitting it in at some point every day as much as I can, whether that's a 2-minute breathing practice on my commute to work on the train, or it's listening to a recorded meditation, guided meditation before bed at night, or whether it's sitting down to an hour meditation once a week, which is what I prefer to do but can't do every day. Finding some time for it. And then the biggest thing is recognizing when you're starting to feel frayed and things are getting a little out of hand, understanding that you need that tool and that that tool is there for you. So not sitting there and being like, well, I have nothing, I better go drink a beer or take a Xanax. Before you get to beer or Xanax or screaming at someone or whatever it is, you have this tool and you need to use it. So you need to use it enough that you develop that muscle memory for it, that it's there for you. And so building in time, find time before you go to bed, for me tends to be the best time. But not guilt tripping yourself about not doing it, just doing it as much as you can.
If you would have to share advice about the top 3 skills that anyone should master early on in a career, maybe not master at that point, but start crafting early in the career, which are portable across jobs and across careers, what would that advice be?
I think the top 3 things I would recommend, one, bring that seek and solve attitude to, you know, anything that you do. You don't know how to do something, there's probably a YouTube video. Google it. Learn that there is no role in which you're going to be hyper equipped for the role, or you're going to be bored out of your mind in a month or less. So any job that you're going to go to, you have to be able to learn on the fly and be comfortable doing that and figuring out what you don't know when you need it. The second one, you know, goes back to what we were just talking about, developing, for me, it's been meditation and yoga, but some practice, some way of grounding yourself so you can see the forest from the trees on a regular basis, or you can get lost in minutia or end up doing work that isn't meaningful to you and not knowing why. You have to be able to step out to get back in. And so I think those 2 things are things I would highly recommend. And then finding your enthusiasm. So, you know, the number one thing that's guided me forward is I have to have enthusiasm for what I'm doing. I have to find it somewhere. So any job, any work will be a dead end if you're doing it because you thought you should, or someone told you you had to, or because it looks good on your resume. You have to find, people call it passion. I like enthusiasm better because passion is like this heady word and it's like, oh, I'm going to find this one thing in my life that I'm passionate about. Guess what? You're probably not. I'm weirdly, wonkily obsessed with health and healthcare. That might be unique, but everyone I know has things that they're enthusiastic about. Whether it's something they like to do in their lives, like cooking or fitness, or whether it's data and tech or video games, I don't care, it's music, whatever it is, find a few things. And that way, if you can find the thread of the thing that you're enthusiastic about in your work, that will carry you. And also be ready for that to change, because the reality of our lives today, I think, is that we're going to have multiple careers. We're going to work in different places. We're not going to be like my grandfather who worked for the same engineering firm after World War II, like until he retired. That doesn't tend to exist anymore. So you're going to have to be ready to find your enthusiasm in various places. And if you are enthusiastic about something, you'll do your best work.
Seek and solve, grounding practice, and enthusiasm.
Yep.
Really nice. Robin, I have three more questions.
Okay.
The first one of the three is, what is something you wish people would ask you and they never do?
Something I wish people would ask me. Well, I guess this, an investor asked me this spring, and I liked this question. He said, what's the question like investors never ask you that you wish they would, or that you're really excited about that investors don't care about? And so I'll answer that one because no one ever asked about this, but we're actually doing some of our own, we're redefining research a little bit at Parsley Health. So today there's no questionnaire that's data validated, that meaning it's like a valid medical instrument in anywhere in the US that asks younger people how they're doing. So we have no scientifically validated measurement until you're really old or really sick to ask what's going on with you physically, which is kind of amazing given 67% of 18 to 45 year olds have at least one chronic condition in the US. And it kind of says it all to me, like, all right, we're waiting until you're really old or really sick and then like dealing with that instead of recognizing that you might be 35, but you might have pain or an autoimmune condition that's brewing or a hormone problem that's going to lead you to absorb tens of thousands of dollars in fertility treatments. Like, we can see all of this coming. And so we've actually developed that at Parsley. It's going into phase three testing this summer. We'll be using it in our population and then working in collaboration with something called the Institute for Functional Medicine and possibly the Cleveland Clinic to then bring that out to the world. And so in addition to building a company and offering a product, we're actually building something that should transform the way that hopefully everyone approaches medical care. And so for me, that's something, you know, people always ask about, like business metrics or retention or margins or profitability or scale plans. And it's like, there's other ways to impact. And I think one of the challenges for me is to balance the like immediate business needs with some of these other goals that I know that if we achieve them, will ultimately indirectly, but very critically, change the way that we impact the world in a really big way.
This is the Role Models podcast. Do you have a role model yourself?
Many. I think that, so I have a rule for role models, and this is a pretty specific rule. And so not everyone may agree with this, but I'll listen to a lot of advice. All sorts of people give me advice. I will only take advice, really take advice, from people whom have all of their houses in order. And by that, I mean their financials, their personal relationships, their business, their physical health. So there's very few people who I look to where I see that they've got it all together. So I see people who have made a lot of money. They have really bad personal relationships. They're divorced seven times all over and their kids don't talk to them. I see people in medicine who are smoking and severely overweight and have health problems that they won't address. All of these things, fairly or not, are red flags to me. And the people who represent role models to me are the people who really take a holistic view of their own lives and define success more broadly than just making money, just having a successful business. And so I've been lucky in meeting people along the way, some of the mentors that I've had who they have great marriages, they have families, they're doing well financially, they're making an impact on the world. And they also seem like relatively happy people. Like, they don't have A, B, C, and D, and they're also simultaneously miserable, because if you're miserable, then it like kind of all doesn't count. And so I've had just a few people that I've worked for or worked with along the way who've stood out to me. And that's, you know, that's also, I think, kept me going, that like, God, am I going to build this whole company only to just, you know, be alone and cry and be sad. Like that's, there's no point to that.
People have their house in order.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
Last question we always ask on a podcast and also at the event series is, what is the piece of advice you would share with your 14-year-old self?
I would, 14 is such a tough age. I would tell my 14-year-old self, you are awesome and these people are crazy. And one day you're going to look back and be like, gosh, I was awesome and they were all crazy. So I think all of us, you know, everyone's a special snowflake. And I grew up in Baltimore and I by no means was a misfit. I had great friends. I was athletic. I did pretty well in school. All of those things that you kind of like want to do as a kid. But I just remember being there and thinking like, I do not fit into this culture. And there's got to be more than like lacrosse and sports and like the things people seem to care about here. Like I didn't see it. I just didn't connect with it. And I kind of knew that there had to be something else out there. But when you're in high school, you're kind of stuck. Like that's where you go to school. You're probably not going to move. You're sort of stuck with this bubble of a reality and you have no agency around it. And leaving that and even just graduating from college and sort of getting out of that school bubble and being able to make my own way for myself in the world was so liberating. So I just want to tell my 14-year-old self, like, this will end and you will have so much more choice available to you in terms of like where you live and how you spend your time, and just like keep your eyes on the prize.
Keep the eyes on the prize. Robin, thank you so much. All the best with Parsley.
Thank you.
This is an excellent vision. I kind of feel like I want to come work for you.
And
where can people if you could leave people with a message, what is an ask you have for people, or what do you want to point them to learn more about you?
Visit us at parsleyhealth.com and subscribe to our newsletter. It's a great way to stay in touch with us, whether you want to learn more about our approach to healthcare, whether or not you want to learn about our company and jobs, we put those out there too. So parsleyhealth.com, sign up for our newsletter. You can also follow us on all the typical social media channels, but we look forward to hearing from you.
Cool. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to Robin for sharing her story, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you want to support the Role Models podcast, you can do this by going to iTunes, by using the star rating, posting a short review about what you think about this episode or the podcast in general. And you can also share the link to this episode with your friends on social media. We have a recommendation for a podcast for you this week. The podcast is called Should We? It's done by two friends of mine, Diana Berlin and Lisa Sanchez. And these are creative conversations about the everyday choices that make us. Thank you again for listening to the Role Models podcast. We really appreciate your support. And we appreciate your comments and the feedback. Reach out to us on Twitter at Role Models and at David if you have any feedback to share. And until then, have a good time.